We'll be reading Abel, chapter 11, verse 8 to 19. The faith of Abraham. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to set out for a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he set out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he stayed for a time in the land he had been promised, and in a foreign land, living in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him at the same promise. For he looked forward to the city that he was foundations, that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, he received power of procreation, even though he was too old, and Sarah herself was barren, because he considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one person, and this one as good as dead, descendants were born, as many as the stars of heaven, and as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. All of these died in faith without having received the promises. But from a distance, they saw and greeted them. They confessed that they were strangers and foreigners on the earth. For people who speak in this way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of the land that they had left behind, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Indeed, he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when put to test, offered up Isaac. He who had received the promise was ready to offer up his only son, of whom he had been told, "It is through Isaac that descendant shall be named after you." He considered the fact that God is able even to raise someone from the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. Amen. God always bless. It's the public reading of inspired and infallible words. Amen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pastor.
Amazing. I love to hear so many different people reading the Word of God, don't you? It is inspiring and wonderfully life-giving. So, faith is not a formula. It is a journey of trust and of obedience and of surrender. And Abraham's life shows us that in so many different ways. He demonstrates to us what it means to live a life by faith in a world that demands that we live by certainty. And certainty and faith are not the same thing. By very nature of its definition, faith is the evidence of things hoped for and the substance of things not seen. Faith is believing God despite the evidence, not just because of it. It's believing God in the midst of circumstances that are trying to drag you away from believing in God, trying to tell you that only what you see, only what you feel, only what you hear, only what you are experiencing is reliable. But faith calls us to believe in that which we cannot see, that which we have been promised, but we cannot always feel. It demands of us eyes that look beyond the normal and the natural and see into eternity. Abraham's faith is a powerful example to us, just as Enoch's has been, and Abel's has been, and Noah's has been before him. So in the roll call of faith, we come to Abraham, perhaps the clearest and most well-known of all of the Old Testament people of God, demonstrating to us what it means to trust God no matter what. Because, sisters and brothers, faith is not safe. It is sacred. It is not comfortable. It is costly. It calls us to surrender what we want, to receive what is the deeper desire. It asks us to go beyond that which is comfortable and into that which is uncomfortable, but God has promised. And hence, all of Hebrews 11, as we journey through it, points us toward that very invitation to trust God, to go further, to go deeper, to listen more carefully, to hold on to the promise that has taken hold of us, and to allow God that somehow to be at work in us, drawing us out of the way we once were and into all that we have been made in Jesus Christ. But remember, whether it was Enoch or Noah or Abraham or Jacob or Deborah or Jephthah or Samson and all the other people that we will be exploring, these are ordinary people. These are men and women with hopes and dreams and aspirations like you and like me, but somehow they were given an extraordinary trust. The ability to trust God in the most impossible of circumstances. I will never be an Abraham. I don't think the world will see another Abraham. I don't think we are supposed to see another Abraham. I'm not sure, those of you that have sons or daughters, whether if God said to you, sacrifice your only son to me, the one that you have longed for all your life, whether you would get as far as Mount Moriah. I know I wouldn't. But Abraham, as we read in this story, was able to trust God in the most exceptional of circumstances, to believe despite years of waiting, to trust despite everything that had happened in his life. And yet, he invites us to a life of faith as well. I remember many years ago, not long after I had been born again, I had become a Christian, listening to a song by an American gospel writer, singer called Steve Curtis Chapman. Does anybody remember Steve Curtis Chapman? Just me. Two, three, maybe now. Those of you that are a bit older are willing to admit, yes, I remember him a little bit. He wrote, he recorded a cassette. That's how long ago it was. I had a cassette, and it was entitled, the album was entitled, The Great Adventure. And it were all songs about faith. The Great Adventure. Stepping into the excitement of what is possible in Jesus Christ. The call to be part of a movement that will see planet Earth changed. And yet so often, church can appear a bit stuffy, a bit boring, a bit predictable, unless, of course, you were in our 11 o'clock service today, which was not predictable and not boring and not stuffy at all. Abraham reminds us of that. Faith in his life was not the absence of fear. It was the presence of obedience. It was the willingness to do what God had asked, despite the uncertainty, despite not knowing what the outcome would be. It's a remarkable life that is reflected on by Paul in his letter to the Galatians and his letter to the Romans and in the writer of Hebrews. Again and again, they return to this one man's life and his wife, Sarah. John Calvin, the famous reformer, said, let us remember that Abraham was not called because he was righteous, but that he was made righteous because he was called. Let me give you a timeline of Abraham's life, if you're taking notes, so that you can go back to it if you want. I take a traditional view of the Bible, and I take a traditional view of Abraham's lifespan. Some modern scholars suggest that he was born about 250 years after what I believe to be his birth time. But I think he was probably born around 2166 BC. That's about as many years before Christ as you are now living after Christ. In fact, it's a bit later than that. His call and the covenant that God established with him is recorded in Genesis 12, which probably happened around about 2091 BC. And God calls Abram, who he later changes the name of, to Abraham, to leave his homeland and promises to make him a great nation. And he begins his journey at 75. Not at 25, not at 30, not at 18. If you're 75 this year, next year, there you are, there's one. That's when Abraham's call began. 75. And when you read carefully what God said to him, he said, leave your homeland, leave your family, leave your father, leave the land that you love. It's almost as if God is rubbing it in. Later on, he does the same thing when he tells him to sacrifice Isaac in Genesis chapter 21. He says, take your son Isaac, your only son, the one whom you love. It's as if God is drilling into his intention and evoking from him the deepest possible emotional response. Leave your father and your father's land, the land that you love, leaving no room for sentimentality. He's going to drill right into what he's asking Abraham to do. And Abraham does it. In Genesis chapter 15 and chapter 17, we read of the promise of a son to Abraham. God reaffirms his covenant to him. He tells him that he will give him descendants that are more numerous than the stars. And at this moment in the story, Abram becomes Abraham and Sarai becomes Sarah. And circumcision is introduced as a sign of the covenant that would mark Israel from that moment to now, and is used as an image in the New Testament of the circumcision of our hearts. I wonder if you've ever stopped to consider this change of name, Sarai to Sarah, Abram to Abraham. There are lots of different ideas around the change of name. It doesn't fundamentally change the meaning of the name unusually, but one of the arguments is, I think, fascinating. You can say Abram and Sarai without that ch sound. It's called an aspirated consonant. If you are to say Abraham, you have to, do you hear the difference? Abram, Abraham. Sarai, Sarah. One of the arguments that some Jewish scholars make around the change of name is that it is possible to say Abram's name without saying the name of the divine one, Yahweh. But it is not possible to say Abraham without also speaking God's name. It's possible to say Sarai without hearing the name of God, but it is not possible to say Sarah without hearing the name of God. Is it possible? I like this theory. I can't prove it, but I like it. That the fundamental change in Abram's identity is that he goes from a man who thinks he can exist without speaking God's name to a man that can only exist because of God's name. Isn't that what happens in us when we are born again? The name of God is spoken over us and in us and around us, and everything is changed as a result. In Genesis chapter 21, we're now around 2066 BC, if you're interested. Isaac's birth happens 25 years after he was promised. Isaac is born when Abraham is 100. And then we read of the deep test of his faith in Genesis chapter 22 when God asks Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, and Abraham obeys. And he's just about to sacrifice his son when God provides a ram in the thicket. There was no ram in the thicket when Jesus died. There was no intervention from heaven saying, there'll be another supply. Of course, Abraham's picture of being willing to sacrifice his son points us to God, who willingly offered his son. But nobody came to the rescue then. There was no voice to stop that moment. There was no intervention to stop what God would go through for us. Some Jewish scholars believe that Abraham did not consult Sarah and left with Isaac, and that Sarah knew that Abraham was going to sacrifice him, and that's what killed her. There's no proof of that, but there's a strong Jewish belief that that is what happened, because immediately after Isaac's return, we read of Sarah's death around 2029 BC, and we're almost now equidistant on this side of the life of Jesus with Abraham and Sarah on the other side of the life of Jesus. And in Genesis 25, around 1991 BC, at 175 years old, Abraham dies, having lived a life marked by trust, obedience, and covenant keeping with God. And he's buried in a cave called Machpelah, which is right in the contested area of the West Bank. What can this remarkable life teach you? Why would we take 45 minutes or so on a Sunday afternoon in 2025 to consider the life of Abraham? Because there is much that he teaches us. Look at Hebrews chapter 11, verse 8 for a moment. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to set out for a place that he was to receive as an inheritance, and he set out not knowing where he was going. Faith steps out without knowing the destination. It is content to take a single step. It doesn't need to know what's around the corner. It doesn't need to know the end result. I think perhaps for many of us as modern believers, we ask God to tell us more than he is going to reveal to us. And I wonder if God said, okay, Rosemond, I'll show you where you're going to be in 10 years. I wonder whether we'd say, no, it's okay. I'd rather you just showed me what was next. Abraham was content to know what was next. He didn't need to know the end of the journey. He didn't need to know the last step. And I think sometimes we are reminded of God's invitation to us that we don't need to know everything. Of course, that repositions us away from being the creators to being created. Learning to live 15 minutes by 15 minutes is the hardest call of the Christian, but it is the one that liberates us. When you're walking through grief, many, many times as a pastor, many times I've sat with someone who's lost somebody unexpectedly, or young, or they are young. And one of their questions to me is, Pastor, how am I going to survive for the rest of my life? And my response is always the same. God isn't asking you to do that. God is asking you to survive for 15 minutes. Get up, make a cup of tea, sit down. Then take the next 15 minutes, and then the next 15 minutes, and the next 15 minutes. And you will come to the end of the day and you will go to bed and you will rise the following morning. And you'll say, I made it through the night. And then take another 15 minutes and another 15 minutes and another 15 minutes and another 15 minutes. And you'll get to the end of that day. And suddenly the 15 minutes become 20 minutes and the 20 minutes become 30 minutes. And you find yourself living in a rhythm where you don't need to know how you're going to live for the next 20 years. I don't think any of us can do that. I don't think that is faith. I think trying to work everything else out is actually a bit presumptuous, but learning to live in the 15 minutes of grace is enough. John Piper, the wonderful American pastor, describes it as the power of future grace. A wonderful book that he wrote about it about 20 years ago. You just need grace for the next moment. You don't need it for the next 10 years. Don't worry about the next 10 years. Just worry about the next moment. Put yourself in a place where you are utterly dependent on the grace of God. And you watch how it changes you. I learned this lesson the hard way. I learned it not through the deaths that I endured. I learned it through our son, Benjamin, who was very, very ill. And we were told so many times that he wasn't going to make it, that it was tearing us apart. My wife and I were trying to work out, how do we get him to 3? How do we get him to 5? How do we get him to 7? How do we get him to 11? Because every time the doctors would say he's going to live a year, 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And it was devastatingly difficult to cope with. Maybe you've gone through something similar. And I remember one particular afternoon sitting with my wife across an old kitchen table made of Formica. Remember Formica? Made of Formica with a cup in each. I had a cup of tea and she had a cup of tea. And I said, Debbie, we can't keep going like this. She said, no, I know. I said, well, how are we going to navigate this? And I said, I wonder if what we need to learn is that it is enough that we have him today. That it is a gift to have our son today. Because if we are not careful, we will spend our life worried about tomorrow and not able to enjoy today. And we will be so caught up with what could be around the corner that we will miss the possibilities of what God is confronting us with and giving us today. And it changed our lives. Still, today, our son is alive. He is 30 next Monday. Next Monday. He's a pastor. He has two children. And my wife and I are flying to Guernsey, where he lives, on Monday morning next week to take, because we have our conference this week, we can't go earlier. We're flying on Monday morning to take him out for dinner for his 30th birthday and then flying back on Tuesday. But it is enough that we have him today. And I think Abraham teaches us something about the capacity to live in that sense of obedience. He didn't need to know the whole future. Faith, you see, sisters and brothers, doesn't begin with full clarity. It begins with obedience. It begins not with show me more. It begins with you have shown me enough. It doesn't begin with tell me what comes after this step. It begins with give me the grace to make this step. And that step might be starting a degree. That step might be starting a business. That step might be moving house. It might be making a gift. It might be releasing a past hurt. It might be being willing to move, to relocate to a different country, to a different environment. It might be starting a church or changing job. Faith that Abraham had gives us the capacity to know the difference between needing full clarity and just needing the strength to say yes. And there is something liberating in just being able to say yes. Having said that, the ability to say yes to a simple request and to be short term in your trust requires a dethronement of your will. Because life is no longer lived on your terms when you live by faith. Life is lived on God's terms. Where you might want a 6-year plan, God might give you a 6-day plan. Where you might want a 3-month journey, God might give you a 3-day one. And that journey invites you to surrender your control. Do you know the people that find it hardest to live by faith? Control freaks and perfectionists. If something goes wrong, they are quick to pick it up. If something goes against what they want, they pick it up and they blame somebody, because their sense of control, their sense of identity is rooted in their controlling a situation and their ability to determine what happens next. The life of faith is not like that. Abraham left security. He left familiarity and he left predictability. What is God asking you to leave behind? Where might your journey of faith take you next? You can look at that as frightening, or you can look at that as exciting. Some of us don't like change. Some of us don't embrace change. Some of us are late adopters. There's nothing wrong with being a late adopter. There is something wrong with being a person who refuses to adopt. But there's nothing wrong with being a late adopter. God works with our personalities and our character traits and helps us to grow. And in my life, this, interestingly enough, has not always been about the big things. My faith has been grown in the small things, in the areas where I perhaps procrastinate and I have to trust God and just get on with something that he's asked me to do? What might God ask us to leave behind as a church on this day when we are seeing our teams consecrated and prayed for? Leave behind the hurts of the past. Leave behind the disappointments of the past. Leave behind the scores that need to be settled, the arguments that need to be won. God can ask us to leave any number of things behind. Sometimes he asks us to leave good things behind. When I had to leave Ireland to come and have the privilege of pastoring you, I had to leave behind a wonderful church and a very happy life. There was nothing wrong with where we were. We loved it. The same had happened when we had to leave England to go to Ireland. Just as I was getting into the flow of really enjoying the season I was in and looking forward to going into a building that I had designed, I was so excited, and the Lord said, no, it's not your building. And I was like, well, I know it's not my building, but I want to enjoy it. He said, no, I don't want you to do that. And I was like, I'm not sure that's fair. And the Lord rebuked me in the way that he rebuked Job. He said, who are you to tell me what's fair and what's not fair? Faith is not about having all the answers. It's about trusting the one who does. And Abraham reminds us of that. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, whose life itself is a mystery to me because he was killed just a few days before the end of the Second World War, executed because of his involvement in a plot to assassinate Hitler. He had been a pacifist and had escaped to New York and was reading from the book of Galatians where Paul says that he is to come before winter, and he felt God calling him back from the safety of New York to Germany, and he knew that he would die. He did not want to be involved in violence, yet he found himself involved in a plot to kill Hitler because he knew that millions of Jews were being killed and he felt that he had to do something about it. So his life was full of those deep and profound contradictions that I am not enabled to answer. But he said this about Abraham. Abraham had to leave his home and go into the unknown. That is faith, to step out into the void, trusting that God will catch you. What void might God be asking you to step into this afternoon? And then, not only is faith stepping out without knowing, faith is also living as a pilgrim. Look at verses 9 and 10 of Hebrews 11 for a moment. By faith, he stayed for a time in the land he had been promised, as in a foreign land, living in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked forward to the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Abraham lived in tents, as a foreigner in the land of promise, as a nomad, never being able to fully set down his roots, never being fully and finally at home in any land at any point. When he was called to leave Ur and to follow God, he was not told where he was to go, he was just told to leave. And he had to learn to live with that sense of constant transition. What then kept him safe in that instability? Because we all need something to keep us safe, don't we? We need a place to call home. I'm just now reading Alan Johnson, the former education secretary's autobiography about his life here in Notting Hill in the 1950s and 60s, and deeply moved by his sense of not having anywhere to call home. He was born in Southam Street, then he moved around about the area. His sister was looking out the window on the day that the man was murdered in 1959, 17th of May, that began whose death led to the Notting Hill Carnival. And he talks of this constant moving from house to house, needing something to anchor his life in, and it took him years to find it. Abraham anchored his life not in a place, not in a moment, but in a promise. He anchored his life in the city that God had promised him. He was looking forward to a city with foundations, a heavenly hope, a city designed by God. And I think there is a deep and a profound challenge for us as Christians today to allow our hope to be rooted in God's promises rather than in our environment. When I became a Christian in 1986, there was a phrase that was used often about people. You probably know it. Oh, she is too heavenly minded to be of any earthly use. Have you heard that phrase before? Well, now I think many Christians are too earthly minded to be of any heavenly use. We've lost our anchoring in the city that God has prepared for us. I even hear Christian theologians and biblical scholars and pastors talking about heaven as an idea, a concept, a feeling, an emotion. Well, where is Jesus? The Jesus that died and rose again went somewhere. He still has a body and he is still there. We have a heavenly hope. We have a promise that anchors us, and it so anchored Abraham that all of the instability around him he was able to cope with, because his mind and his heart was set on Christ, on God as his home. He was looking forward to a city with foundations. It was a staff meeting, and I had called some of our mission partners together for a retreat day. And about 20 of my staff team in Gold Hill were circled around me for a wonderful day. And I'd set the theme out and we'd prayed and we'd worshipped. And I said, let's start on my left and go around the room and just tell everybody else your name and where is home for you. So one person, my name is James, home is Chalfont St. Peter. It's where I was born and brought up. I love it here. Another, my name is Maria. My home is Weston-super-Mare. I like to go back and walk by the sea. I miss the sea. Me, Malcolm. My name is Malcolm. Home for me is Ireland. I miss the sea too. And we went round the room and one by one we heard, my home is Oxford. My home is here. My home is here. My home is here. My home is here. And then we came to Jude, who was sitting beside me. Jude is a missionary, and she is Scottish, but she is in Indonesia. Her father was a missionary. Her mother is a missionary. Her whole family were missionaries. And she said, my name is Jude, and Jesus is my home. I don't really feel at home anywhere, she said. I know where he's called me, but he is my home. And wherever he wants me to be is home. And I don't need very much. And the room fell silent. A few days later, a man who was actually a priest in the Catholic Church around the corner met me for coffee. He was a renewed priest. He loved Jesus very much. And he said, Malcolm, I am leaving. John, his name is. I said, where are you going? And he said, I'm going back, and he named a country in Africa. And I said, but you've only been here for 3 months. How can you be leaving so quick? He said, well, he was a Carmelite. I was going to say something funny. He's a Carmelite. And he said, my order requires me to go. And I said, I don't understand. What are you going to do with all of your stuff? You've only just got here. What are you going to do with all of your stuff? And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, well, that's not difficult to answer when your stuff amounts to a pair of shoes, a suit, and a Bible. That is my stuff. He said, when I committed my life to serving Jesus, I gave up everything I had. So I have no stuff. And I thought, I wonder how many Pentecostals could say that. I wonder how many of us, if God said move, could say, I have no stuff, that's easy. It took me a year to unpack my books. That's how much stuff I have. And they're still not unpacked. Abraham had this ability to follow God, to set his hope on God, because within this man was a pilgrim soul. One of my favorite poets is the Irish poet W.B. Yeats. And he writes a poem about an old lady that he's sitting over a fire with. And she's getting wrinkly and old, and he's getting wrinkly and old. And he says to her, as we come to the end of our lives, many people loved much about you when you were young and vibrant and beautiful and all of those things. And then he has this killer line. I put it on my cards to Debbie when I want to impress her. But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you. God calls us to have a pilgrim soul, to travel lightly, to let our faith and our hope, like Abraham's, be built on heaven, on the home that will never spoil, on the promise that will never fade or corrupt, as Peter calls it. Therefore, the satisfaction of our temporal needs, our sexual desires, our location, our position, our power, how many bedrooms our houses have, how many cars we drive, what our view is, it all fails to impress you when you realize that what you need more than anything else is a heavenly hope that anchors your soul, which is worth sacrificing everything to keep and to keep at the center of your life. I think Abraham learned the lesson that faith means living with eternity in view and not just settling for temporary comfort. Because, brothers and sisters, the truth is we are settlers when we should be sojourners. Most of us are too comfortable. Most of us are too comfortable. Abraham's life teaches us that faith is not about having all the answers. It's about trusting the one who does, even when the road is long and the promise feels very far away. So what do you and I build our lives on? In the words of Jesus, do we build on sand or on foundations that will last? What does it mean in 21st century London to be a pilgrim in our culture? How do we demonstrate this pilgrim heart to the people around us? Perhaps by holding our possessions lightly. Perhaps by being generous with our money and our time. Perhaps by challenging the culture around its understanding of satisfaction and entitlement and desire and stuff and position and power. And living in such a way that we live lightly and people are attracted to it. They see a lightness in our spirit and they want it too. Abraham, who stepped out in faith without knowing where he was going and who learned to live as a pilgrim. And Abraham, who teaches us that faith waits on the impossible. Look at verses 11 and 12. By faith, he received the power of he received power of procreation, even though he was too old and Sarah herself was barren, because he considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one person, and this one as good as dead, this one as good as dead, descendants were born, as many as the stars of heaven and as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. Sarah received power to conceive because she considered God faithful. Abraham believed in a promise that defied biology. A promise that defied logic. A promise that everyone else would laugh at. But they believed it, and God met them. Faith is not passive, it is an act of trust in God's character. And faith teaches us the power of waiting. And waiting is not weakness. Write this down. Waiting is worship. How many lives of silent worship have been offered to God as people wait for a promise to be fulfilled? Abraham waited and waited and waited, and his waiting was an act of worship and trust. Sarah waited and waited and waited, and her waiting was a declaration of worship and of trust. What promises are you waiting on? I have promises in my life that I'm waiting on. Promises that were made to me 10 days after I became a Christian. I'm waiting on them. I believe that God will fulfill them. And I will wait as worship. I will tether myself to the hope that is holding on to me. But that means that I must learn, like you, to wait well in a world of instant gratification. And I can be surrounded by a spirituality of instantaneous. We want it all and we want it now. We want the book of Acts in every service. Forgetting that the book of Acts took place over 40 years. That actually, we sometimes appear like greedy children before God, putting our hand in the sweetie jar and saying, give me more, give me more, give me more. And we're still savoring the last mouthful while we shove another one into our mouth. And God sometimes says, can you just wait a minute? I, in bringing up our children, learnt the power of waiting. Around Christmas time, when I would hear four children like little ferrets running around under beds looking for things, trying to find presents, squeezing gifts to see what was in them. I learned the power of waiting, because when it got to Christmas Day and they opened, we don't open our presents on Christmas Day until after lunch. And our kids would say, everybody else opens their presents as soon as they get up in the morning. Well, we don't in this house. Well, that's no fair. But then slowly they began to realize that when everybody else was going home bored, they were going home to open their presents. And then we would teach them to take their presents and put them all somewhere and play with one a day across the Christmas season. Instead of throwing them all into a pile, using them all, discarding them and being bored the following day. My wife, every year, would buy 10 or 20 pence presents for Boxing Day. And honestly, our kids enjoyed those presents more than they enjoyed the presents on Christmas Day. They learned to wait for Christmas dinner. And now I'm not allowed to change how I cook the carrots. I'm not allowed to change where I put potatoes on a plate. Everything has to be the same, because they live in this excitement, this anticipation of all that they're going to enjoy, except for this year, where they're all married and with their own family, and my wife and I are on our own for the first time in 33 years, and we're going to a restaurant in Covent Garden for Christmas lunch, and I can't wait. And I'm not telling any of you where it is in case you turn up. Sarah held on to what God had promised. Waiting in a culture of instantaneous is one of the strongest witnesses to our world. Learning to wait well in a season of instant gratification, in a world where it's buy now, pay later, is a powerful witness. And then we have Abraham's faith that sees beyond death. Verses 13 to 16. All these died in faith without having received the promises, but from a distance they saw and greeted them. They confessed that they were strangers and foreigners on the earth, for people who speak in this way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. What a wonderful phrase. If they had been thinking of the land that they had left behind, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country. That is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Indeed, he has prepared a city for them. These people, Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, died in faith. None of them received the full promise. They saw it from afar and they welcomed it. Because our faith in the end is also faith that sees beyond death. It sees beyond the grave, perhaps the most defiant thing a Christian can do is die well, believing that death is not the end, holding on to the promise that it is simply a change of address, that we announce that the devil has lied when he says this is the end. That we know it is not the end. That we know that there is something beyond that. I am struck by the language of this passage in Hebrews 11. He had a longing for a better country, which was stronger than his nostalgia for where he had left. You cannot look in both directions. You will either want to go back or you will follow the call forward. Which is it? The language here is so beautiful. Verse 14, for people who speak in this way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. And if they had been thinking of the land that they left behind, they would have had the opportunity to return. If you're always thinking about where you've been, something in you longs for it more than where you're going. The only way to address that is to burn that bridge. To deal with once and for all where your heart is set. That's why Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Seek first God's kingdom and his righteousness, and everything will be added to you. For people who look and live like that, Hebrews 11 tells us God is not ashamed to be called their God. God is not ashamed to be called the God of those who long for their homeland. And our homeland is Christ. Jude, my missionary friend, was right. Faith is not just for this life. Faith is for the life to come. And one day when we see him face to face, we will not require it anymore. Because our faith will be made sight. Do you and I live for the eternal or for the immediate? What legacy of faith are we leaving? And lastly, faith surrenders that which is most precious. In verses 17 to 19, we read of Abraham surrendering Isaac. He offered him. And the passage here tells us more than the Genesis passage tells us. The Genesis passage simply tells us that Abraham had trust that God would do something. This passage tells us that Abraham offered Isaac, trusting that God could raise the dead. That's not in the original text. The indication is that Abraham was willing to offer Isaac because he knew that even if he died, God would raise him again. What a faith. Nevertheless, he was willing to offer that which was most precious. I fear that there are things in my life that are still too precious for me to offer to God. That there are people in my life that I would find it very difficult to release into the hands of Almighty God. But I want to be the person that will. There will come a moment in your life when you will have to surrender someone that you love. It might be a parent. It might be a partner. But all of us will have to let go of somebody's hand for the last time. That is an incredibly difficult thing to do. But in that moment, if you are able to remember the grace and the mercy of God, you will be given grace and mercy to live through it. Because this is the power of the gospel. In the moment where you feel as if you are surrendering that which is most precious, you discover that you're held by the one who is most precious. That he never lets you fall. That when you feel as if you're drowning, his feet always touch the bottom. I have discovered, as I've considered the life of Abraham and in my own life, that faith is a radical surrender. It is a giving back to God what God has given to us. Faith is not just believing. Faith is relinquishing. Faith is surrendering. Faith is taking your hands off and letting God be God. What are you holding too tightly to today? Who are you holding too tightly today? Are you willing to trust God with those whom you love the most. To trust his timing. To trust his compassion. To trust that the judge of the earth will do what is right. Abraham, a life marked with obedience and pilgrimage, with waiting and vision and surrender, invites you and I to remember today that faith is not a moment, it is a lifestyle. He invites us to live as people of faith in a world of fear. And he confronts us with this simple reality, sisters and brothers. Faith is not a theory. Faith is a testimony. Faith is not a concept. Faith is a calling. So I pray for you today, as I pray for myself, that you might have courage to obey, that you might have strength to wait, that you might have vision to live for eternity, and that you might have trust to surrender. Amen.